as well. So right now, the timing of these projects, we start drawing on a line of credit, for example. We take money when we need it, but we don't pay interest until we take the money. So we slowly increase the interest cost as we take down line of credit draws, and that what that allows us to do is minimize financing costs in the near term.
How do the financing costs compare what the market provides in a bond versus line of credit?
They're pretty comparable. We can negotiate very effective terms with banks. They have a certain time frame that they're most interested in, up to about 5 years. And those rates that we see from banks versus a public offering are really pretty comparable during that time frame. So we're not really seeing an interest rate penalty, but we're seeing quite a bit of difference in flexibility and the way in which we would have to structure a long-term versus a line of credit type.
Just one more question for Patrick. Patrick, we the council voted to give urban renewal a haircut, so we shrunk urban renewal last year. Now we're talking about some financing that would occur outside of urban renewal tools. Was that contemplated when we took the haircut that if we wanted to proceed with the post office, we'd have to do financing outside of urban renewal?
Well, I mean, the conversations, I think, were fairly early, but I think we were aware that we would have this cash flow issue. The reduction in River District did not affect us reaching maximum indebtedness. So that was the whole point of the River District reduction, was that we could remove substantial assessed value from urban renewal, put it back in the tax rolls without affecting our ability to access maximum indebtedness. So we still have the capacity, the same capacity we had before the reduction. So this would have been an issue regardless.
But now that you have a proposal on the post office, I guess the next obvious question is, to what extent would either you or Ken suggest we revisit priorities that are listed under interim financing? Because what you've done is you've given us a menu that assumes we continue to fund everything, and you've given us a way to do that. But it does beg the question, if we're going outside of urban renewal now and we're using the general fund as the backstop, ought we take a second look at whether these are truly priorities in light of if we're going to give the green light to the post office?
I mean, from my point of view, that's certainly an option. What we've done in terms of bringing a concept plan to you is made the assumption that all of the projects that are currently slated to be completed in the district would be completed. The post office wouldn't compete with them or push those out. And how would we accommodate a post office financing and do it in a way that minimized impacts to the general fund and risk to the general fund? So if we revisit that, because if we, for example, said, you know, we like the idea, we think this is a great opportunity, we're uncomfortable with the amount of the financial risk or exposure, how do we change that? One of those things, I mean, let's reduce some of those projects. What that would mean is that the general fund backed line of credit exposure, which right now maximizes at about $45 million, would be reduced. And that would be one way to manage risk. We have other ways that we've built into the plan so far that we think manage the risk as well, and I'll talk about that. But that certainly is something that would be considered. We started from the standpoint that nothing will be crowded out and nothing will be given up in order to accommodate this. How can we build a plan around that?
And I'd just say philosophically, the reason why that is not, there's not to, let's not make any hard choices. I wasn't thinking is that this is a unique opportunity to leverage the availability of TIF in a once again, a way that can be managed so that at the end of the district, you actually have, you've created even more value in the district that accrues back. So you actually have leveraged your TIF dollars even more by doing it this way, as opposed to taking a kind of more modest approach to development. So I mean that's also part of what this choice was. This is an opportunity that pays us back as opposed to a sunk cost that we never get out. Sorry, Commissioner.
I agree with Commissioner Fish. I think we do need to look again at the rest of the list and see, do we still want to buy everything? My other questions are, what do we pay back the general fund line of credit with?
So that's, we're going to get to that.
Okay, you're going to get to that. I had one more question.
So if you look at the chart that we have, it shows the cumulative cash flow, either deficit or surplus for the River District. What you'll see is that we accumulate deficits during the first 5 or 6 years of the plan as we spend money on all of the different projects, acquire the post office site, and put it back out for sale. In 2021-22, that time frame, we have assumed the first property sale, or the first phase of the post office property is sold. And we sell that for approximately $40 million. At that point in time, that $40 million property sale, along with other resources of the district, pay in full the outstanding general fund back line of credit. So in 2022 calendar year, on our projection right now, the general fund would be taken out with those proceeds. And at that point in time, future sales of property for the post office would certainly contribute to the ability to do other things or to the surplus that you see in this forecast.
Has the city budget office looked at this?
They have not looked at it yet, no.
I'd like to know their assessment.
Is that $40 million from the phase one?
Yes.
Sale only?
Yes, only phase one. Phase two is an assumed sale several years later at $73 million. But that money is not needed to take the general fund out at that point in time. So basically what we have is we've added a third piece of resource to the River District's funding mix. They have TIF, they have program income now. Now we'd have a general fund back line of credit. That would be used to fund the projects we've talked about. And in exchange for that, we get the ability to achieve those land sale values as a resource that currently doesn't exist in the River District plan and use that to pay off the general fund. And so what we have is a way to try to manage the timing problem. We have a cash flow issue, we have a color of money issue, and we have a resource issue. And by using these things, I think, in the manner that we've laid out, we can solve for those three issues, and that's what we've done.
So with the general fund line of credit, presumably we have to make some payments on it. What do we make that? Where do we get the money for making the payments?
The assumption right now is, well, we're carrying that line of interest, the line of credit, interest costs we pay for from primarily program income of the district.
So it's factored in.
It's factored in.
So when you see the deficit on the bar chart, that's including making payments on interest costs.
So with TIF, in other words.
Yes. Well, it's program. So it's TIF, but it's.
What do you mean by program income?
So program income is not from debt proceeds. This is revenue that we receive from repaid loans, property sales, fees that we earn on assets. So it's the parking around Union Station. You know, we get revenue off of that, or Station Place parking. So we generate every year a fair amount of program income, given the size of River District. That money goes back into our program that funds the work we do and it lessens our borrowing needs. In this case, it actually is an additional resource that we can use and we can use to cover interest costs.
Right.
And is the program income district by district? Does it stay within each district?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Do we? Could you get us a list of how much programming income?
Yeah,
it's
on the budget every year. You okay. Actually. So
there's a lot on the budget every year. So.
I know. So Tony, I want to hand this out. These are the numbers behind the bar chart, and it actually has a line for program income that's projected in here.
So I was going to finish, because I know there will be more questions, but because I can anticipate, well, what happens if the property isn't sold in 2021, 22? What happens if it isn't sold for the amount that we think it might be sold for? What's the worst-case scenario? What happens then?
Well, that's one of my later questions. What keeps you up at night, Mr. CFO?
Yeah.
So thank you.
So if I was only relying on that, I'd be more nervous. But what we've tried to do, and we've had a lot of experience with this. I mean, the mayor mentioned at the outset the different projects that the city's been engaged in, Pearl District, South Waterfront Airport, Light Rail. I've been involved in all of those. And we've constructed financing plans that have enabled that to happen. And they haven't always worked exactly as we thought they would, but they've never resulted in a burden to the general fund.
Even though in the case of the airport project, we had a catastrophe that stopped all airport development for quite a while, and a recession.
So I'm pretty comfortable about what it takes to make something work, and I think what we have here is a plan that should enable us to be successful, but also sustain bad news if that happens. So for example, we're gonna rely primarily on property sales, and if it happens, in the amount and the time that we expect that we have in the forecast, general fund gets taken out and it's not an issue. But if that doesn't happen, then we have program income that we talked about that can continue to carry interest cost until we realize those property sales. We have some additional reserves that are tied up in the tax increment fund right now for bond reserves. As we get to the last issuance of tax increment bonds during this time period, That can release some funds that would help offset some of the line of credit costs that we have. And then ultimately, in about 2025 or 26, the River District indebtedness that for the tax increment will be fully repaid. And all of the remaining increment assessed value will return to the tax rolls and be available for property tax revenues for all overlapping jurisdictions, including the City of Portland. We estimate at 2026 or that time frame, that's about $11 million a year of additional revenue that the city will be receiving. That's currently not in any forecast. It's beyond the five-year period. And if necessary, worst case, not what I would like, but if we weren't able to be at that point in time successful in taking down the line of credit, we know that we have a new set of resources that could allow us to unwind the financing, recognizing that at some point in time, the property will be sold and the sale proceeds will be used to reimburse the city. We're going to have an intergovernmental agreement with PDC that will make sure that in the event that timing becomes an issue and other resources are used by the city will be made whole by future sale of the project. So it really, that's how we manage the risk, and that's why I'm not too worried about that. Now, clearly, we'd like to have it all work under the first plan where all the general fund is unwound by the sale of the property. But we have two or three other legs of the financing stool to protect us. I think that's a prudent thing to do, and I think it's a reasonable thing to do. And it's the kind of strategy that we've used very effectively in a lot of these other development projects.
Why does the programming can bounce around so much from 7 to 11 to 2 to 6 to 6 to 2?
Yeah, Commissioner, that's a combination of planned property sales and income from the loan portfolio. So loan collections is a more constant amount. There are some balloon payments assumed for certain payoffs.
So it's built from actual assets. So a certain loan matures in 2020. So plug in back in payment.
Right.
Right, and then next year we're going to have a big loan repayment, so it does bounce around because it is that kind of activity that causes it.
So if we borrow a lot of money, is $2 million enough to pay the debt service on it?
We've assumed right now that the borrowing cost would be 5% a year. So if we had $40 million outstanding, that's $2 million a year. That's just interest only, just for example. So generally speaking, we think that that will work. We know, this thing does porpoise around a bit, and we also think that if we release some of the reserves coming out of the tax increment district, that will be used to pay down the general fund line of credit. So we're looking at ways to manage and reduce that risk exposure. I will say there is risk. I'm not going to tell you that there is no risk. The question is, how big is that risk, and how do we manage that risk, and do we have tools available for us to manage the risk? I think we do have tools available to manage that risk so that we can avoid a draw on general fund resources that is not expected.
But it looks like on this that if the project gets delayed and we can't sell the post office in 21-22, that the general fund is at risk.
What we would do at that time, under that kind of worst case scenario, if the line of credit comes due at that point, we're not able to have refinanced it or paid it off, we'll do a longer-term borrowing. We'll go back and we could do a 10-year bond issue. We could do another line of credit. The line of credit will go away, but it doesn't mean we don't have the ability to refinance that and extend the term and do other things. And that's exactly what we would do.
So yeah, and let me add a little bit more detail to that. So the way the cash flow is built is, I'll just point you to three line items. One is up the top, sale of the post office. You see that's the proceeds that we get in from the planned sales. So the first one is in 2021-22, that's about $40 million. The second one is in 25-26 at 73. If you go down closer to the bottom, you have the cost of the post office acquisition, which we have as $80 million paying out over the next basically 2.5 years. And then you have post office infrastructure, which pays out in different increments. You can see in 18-19, 19-20, 2021, and then you have it again in 26, 27. Those infrastructure investments are timed to match up with our disposition of the property. So we also have discretion in when we make those investments. So if we don't see on the horizon either a buyer or a market that's receptive to that, then we don't have to actually make those investments. So we don't actually have to think about how to do the sidewalks and the streets if we don't actually have a buyer lined up. So So we would also be able to control the city's exposure through how quickly we spend money. And it maxes out, right? So it starts out small and maxes out at 43. Depending on the timing of it and how the sale lines up with our investments, we could manage that exposure if we really had to. And so that's really going to be what the market is at that moment, and we don't, right? We none of us can forecast that well. But
one specific question and one big fat question I was going to hold to the end, but we're reaching the end. The specific question is, when you say sale of property, $40 billion phase one, $73 million phase two, those are two separate things, right? They're not cumulative.
Correct.
So you're anticipating getting 113. Yes. So on the face of it, that sounds like a good deal. You buy something for $80 million and you sell it for $113 million. Is that the idea, or is it a lot more complicated than that?
Yeah, I mean, if you want, we can walk through this next slide, but there's more value in the property actually than that, because the value of the FAR that we're setting aside for housing is about $30 million, $31 million. So the property ends up being worth somewhere in excess of $140 million. The property right now, under its current zoning, current use, current condition, is worth somewhere between $60 and $70 million. When we take possession of it, when the entitlements on the property changes, when infrastructure investments are made, we are adding value to the property, and so we're adding value, and you're also taking a property that really has no market right now, and you're actually creating a market for it. Right, right now it's a single use, right, low density site that right. So yes, we are adding value, but and then trying to realize the benefits of that increase in value.
So my big question is, I think that, I mean, we know what people are going to say if we do this. They're going to say that you're going to, I mean, you've got, your streets are crumbling, you've got a homeless crisis, and you're spending $80 million in a post office. So I think that in order to most effectively respond to that, I'd like to see three scenarios. One is, two scenarios in addition to this one. One is, if we did nothing with the post office, and if we decided we're never going to spend any money on it, and that enables us to do earlier defeasance of the River District, what does our financial picture look like over the next, say, 25 years? A second scenario I'd be interested in seeing, although you might explain to me that this is silly, is we're talking about getting a bunch of public benefit out of this property. What if we said, no, we just want to sell this property to the highest bidder and make whatever investments are necessary to have any sale work, and simply cash out as quickly as possible without worrying about parks and housing, affordable housing, et cetera. How much additional cash we get out of that theoretically we could spend on things like parks and affordable housing somewhere else? And then compare those two scenarios to this scenario.
And on the first scenario, just so I clarify, the impact, meaning what's lost revenue to the city long term? I mean, because it's status quo is what it is.
Status quo with the twist that if we assume that if we take the post office out of consideration, then there's $40 million that now planning to spend in the post office or $35
right.
Be,
right
that
exactly.
We wouldn't be planning.
Right, you're right.
So
yep.
We would be able to return more property to the tax rolls more quickly. And by the way, one thing that obviously is an important factor in this discussion, which I think the public should know, is that right now we can't tax the post office. So right now we're getting no property taxes out of it.
Right.
So I think Lisa talked about this as for being an incremental thing, but to me it's kind of a big deal to be able to say, here's how much additional property tax revenue we think we're going to be getting once this goes onto the tax rolls.
Just a kind of a quick answer with knowing a little bit about the backdrop of these numbers. I think that currently if we did this project versus the status quo, the released AV or the district's payoff of debt changes by about a year. So that might be $11 million that we receive sooner versus later. In exchange for
35,
that,
you could invest in something else, but it doesn't shorten the time frame to pay off the debt.
So okay. In exchange for that, if you imagine the development that we don't know all of what will be the taxable development and its value, but there will be a substantial amount of new taxable value that will be created that will generate property tax revenues. If it's $500 million of a development, not an unreasonable amount, that's $2 million a year to the general fund, plus business license tax, plus potential utility license fee. So there's you know, in excess of probably $2+ or more million on a perpetual basis, discounted on a present value basis, that's probably on a, you know, $20 or $30 million easily. So I think that the payback relative to the status quo is pretty substantial and pretty quick.
Can I just follow up on Steve's second option? Because, Patrick, we talked about this when you briefed me, and one thing you explained to me was if the post office moves, they have to have a public partner to handle that transaction. They can't go get a private developer to do that. So that puts us in the driver's seat in terms of managing that transaction. But to Steve's point, the way to potentially, and I'm not advocating for this, but I just want your reaction, the way to potentially eliminate any downside risk to the city and its taxpayers is to explore whether someone's willing to buy our position out the day after we close. And if there are five or six reputable development companies that see a 13-acre urban tract as being irresistible, and they come in and say, we'll give you $100 million, and we say, you know, there's going to be all kinds of covenants and restrictions on this, and we're going to have to work with us on the development, but if you're willing to do that, we'll take it. We've just eliminated our risk. We've also perhaps lost some leverage about how we develop it, and there might even be an upside that we're losing. But doesn't that completely eliminate our downside?
Yeah, theoretically, and I think we've explored that scenario with the Postal Service. It's not something that they allow with this type of transaction. So their goal in yeah, you can't. There's no flip scenario. So we have to hold and take ownership of the property and in some way add value, and then we can put it out. So basically, if you go back to the initial timeline, you're basically just accelerating this sale. So you know, we don't take possession of the property until end of 2018. We could sell it as quickly as possible right at that moment. But we're going to be outlaying money beginning in 2016. Right, so that's the difference.
Let me restate it.
Yeah.
Someone comes to you tomorrow and says, let's make it very simple. Donald Trump drops out of the presidential sweepstakes. He comes and knocks on your door and he says, Warren Buffett? Okay, whoever, your favorite developer knocks on the door. With a big heart and
have a favorite developer. I just want to go on record here.
a record of public spirited development, and says, I want that 13 acres. In fact, in my hip pocket, I've got Google that wants to move its headquarters here, and I want that dirt, and I'm going to make a lot of money. So you go ahead and do all your legal mumbo jumbo. But the next day after you have site control, I'll write you a check for $100 million, and then we manage to give me the property. And maybe you can only give it to me on a 1,000-year lease or something because the post office has some rule. But I'm just that's really Steve's second point. I think that's the point that a lot of people in the public are going to ask, because it's the way that we eliminate our risk and transfer to the private sector the risk. And if we believe it's such an attractive piece of dirt, theoretically there are people out there that share that conviction. So I'm just...
Yeah, and once again, I just want to... just to add a little bit more nuance to that scenario, because I think that's a scenario that we can pursue. But if we acquire a property, use public dollars to acquire it, we have to put it out for competitive bid. We have requirements around it. So we would still behave like we would on any other property that we own, and it could still generate an immediate kind of sale of property. But there can't be any side deals between now and when we put it out. We have to actually finish the process, and then once we take possession, we can put it out for public bid. I mean, I think that's the way I would respond. Is I think the scenario is possible, but it would have to be a pretty open process. That's right. That's right. Can I? I don't know what the time limit here. I just want to quickly run through this chart because there's some. There's just a lot of kind of questions that revolve around how we pay for things on site, and And it's not a straightforward, you know, we have money budgeted, we pay for it. It's actually, there's more opportunity than that, is I guess the way I would say it. So this just highlights, once we've acquired the site, we then have things we want to do with the site. And so if you look at this first two columns, the first green and kind of reddish and pink column in the first phase, we have at our disposal, we have the proceeds from the line of credit. We have basically the value of the affordable housing that we've set aside out of the FAR, which is phase one is about $60 million. We have the anticipated proceeds from the land sales. We have additional TIF that's budgeted, and we also have SDCs that are being created from the development. And then we have a set of needs with those dollars, including paying back our line of credit. But then after that, you have the value of this affordable housing. We have streets that need to be built. We have open space that needs to be built. And then we have, as Commissioner Saltzman brought up in the beginning of the session, we have the need to actually find subsidy for the affordable for basically the FAR that we've created. And so potentially out of this bucket of sources, especially if SDCs can cover some of the cost of infrastructure on site, then we actually have money to subsidize some initial construction of those 300 units, not all 300 units, but we actually would be able to do roughly half of them. And then the upside is in the second phase where, as you can see, we get the full value of the land back. We still have the FAR that we've dedicated from the affordable housing piece. So that's, once again, another 300 units and SDCs. But because we've covered the line of credit costs, we actually have the potential to cover the construction of not just the 300 units from phase two, but also the 150 that weren't constructed in phase one. So you can potentially absorb all of the costs of the 600 units of housing within the transaction. It's obviously a timing consideration, as well as the open space needs and infrastructure needs. If there's a desire for more affordable housing to be built in the first phase, then have it backloaded, then we need to bring additional resources to bear. And by that time, there may be additional resources given the current conversation. But that's the both the challenge and the opportunity we have with the money that's coming in through this transaction.
Let me stop you there, Patrick, because we have covered a lot of ground in a big, complicated transaction in a relatively short time, and I want to make sure that council members have a chance, maybe in something of a lightning round format, to get questions and next steps requests on the table so that the team here can continue to develop this proposal and people get their questions answered. So I know you've got some, Commissioner Fish.
Lightning round. Lightning.
Yes.
That's a subtle hint. I just go through my notes. I agree with Commissioner Prince. I think the parcel in front of PNCA should be part of a master planning process. And after all, we want to be thinking about dynamically linking the North Park blocks with whatever it is north. So, number two, I think Ken agreed that we take a look at the interim financing box and with PDC come back to us with what would be the alternatives in terms of lowering our exposure if we either killed or delayed any of the projects in there. The one I know the least about is all this is going to be handled. But I'd be interested in that. Three, it's not for this. This is a bigger subject than we can tackle right now, but what I'm getting the sense of is that we haven't quite declared what kind of housing would go there. And I think we're going to have to, as a policy matter, be a little clearer about what this is. For example, is this 30% housing? We get into this debate a lot because obviously 30% is a floor, not a ceiling. PDC can always invest above 30%. But unless we're clear about what it is, then the goalposts keep shifting. So I'm operating the assumption that this is 30% housing.
You mean 30%
set aside? 30% set aside housing. It falls within the set aside guidelines. But that's not quite how your presentation presents it. So if you're anticipating using public resources to go beyond the set aside, I want us to be very clear about what you're contemplating and what's the rationale for using scarce public resources to do that, because right now, we typically only use incentive programs, not our federal funds, not our TIF dollars, to fund outside the set-aside. So I don't want to back into that discussion. If the Housing Bureau, you, one of my colleagues, thinks we should have that, I want to put it on the table and not back into it, because my view is the default is we're operating under the set-aside guidelines. And that has with it not only income restrictions and expectations, but it also has existing mixes of housing, which has been hammered out for the framework. So anyway, I'm just saying, please flag that at the front end, and let's not treat it as a back end consideration, because it either is or it isn't. And I'm operating the assumption that it is. And finally, just want to restate what I said earlier. I thought the end game on Northern McAdam as a process involving council and PDC was superb. And it was a really challenging process. But we got, I think, to the right place. And what I learned in that process is, unless we are really intentional about the dollars and the dirt and the timeline, there's the potential for the affordable housing piece to slide. And that's not for nefarious reasons, it's just the nature. So when I hear you say there is a potential for a plan B, where we acquire the dirt and someone wants to put a business there, we have to think about, you know, transferring the dollars for a public benefit off-site. That begins to sound a little bit like North McAdam, and I think we have to be very clear about what that means. Dollars, kinds of housing, and timeline. But this is a superb presentation on a very complicated matter. Thank you.
One quick statement and then a question. The quick statement is simply that the commute mode split matters to me a lot, and development in an area you can actually anticipate that 85% of commute trips would not be single occupancy vehicles, that's something to put a value on. So that's one of the reasons I'm willing to consider this. But the question is, I think a lot of people think, well, we've got a hot real estate market now. It could cool down. The sooner you turn this around, the more likely it is that the market will still be hot. Is there a prospect that by going with a scenario where you are just turning it around and selling to the highest bidder as quickly as possible without worrying as much about making public investments in this location, does that speed up the timeline and therefore does it reduce the risk that the market will go south?
I'm happy to answer that one right now. I think there's still a built-in timeline of the post office getting a new site constructed and moving out. And so for the sake of conversation, we'll just assume it's the end of 2018. We're 6 years into an expansion here. We just saw somebody this morning who was talking about how they believe that supply is beginning to not catch up, but it's beginning to affect rents. So 2 years from now, I'm not going to make any bets. But history tells us that at some point we're going to hit the top of this cycle. So my advice, the way Ken and I talk about this, is this is next cycle investment. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That doesn't imply down market investment. It just implies, you know, we actually have the city has the luxury of thinking about the next cycle and being prepared for the next cycle. And I think that's what we should do. At the end of the day, we can decide that the best thing from a risk management standpoint is to move this property as quickly as possible. But I don't think we should go into this thinking that we're going to hit the top of the market. I think that still would be more of an expedient, take a lower price kind of outcome than it would be trying to time the market.
I agree with that. That's a very good characterization that this is the next cycle investment. It's important to flag and mentioned it in passing earlier. The receiving sites for the post office are here in this cycle.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So in addition to the things my colleagues have mentioned, I'd like to hear from the City Budget Office regarding their assessment of the plan. And on the framework plan, I'm concerned that the way the building orientation is doesn't really relate to the river. And I think that's a missed opportunity. I would have had the end of the site facing the river more. You can't see the river at the ground level because of the way the bridge goes down, but you would be able to if you have 400-foot high towers. So I would suggest that could be some really wonderful office and or living space mm-hmm. if it looks at the river instead of looking not at the river.
Well, I think it needs further work, a deeper dive with the Housing Bureau on the affordable housing goals, the projected targets. As I mentioned earlier, the Central City Plan calls for 30% target for affordable housing and 80% MFI. The FAR stuff sounds, floor area ratio stuff, it just comes across to me as entirely too speculative. And maybe that's just my own ignorance about how these FAR transfers really work. And I'll be the first to admit that I often fake that I know what FAR is and I don't.
Okay.
So, but it just sounds speculative, and it kind of like Commissioner Fish was saying, we would end up dealing with housing as an afterthought, or if the FAR value doesn't materialize, we don't get it done. And I just don't think I can support this plan right now with a 25% affordable housing goal. I think it's got to be at least 30% affordable housing goal. And we can nuance all we want the difference between 25% FAR goal and 30%, but people don't get it. They understand 30% set asides, but I don't think they understand, as I myself barely understand, how we're getting to a 25% housing goal here. And I think it's got to be at least 30%, and the Housing Bureau's got to be more at the table with you on developing these scenarios out.
Thank you.